From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Later this spring, the Dalai Lama is scheduled to visit Iowa. So this hour, we look at the origins of Buddhism and how it has been adapted to Western culture. We'll talk with David Grubin, director of the upcoming PBS documentary, The Buddha, narrated by Richard Gere, to air on April 7th. We'll also talk with Stephen Asma, author of the new book, Why I Am a Buddhist, No-Nonsense Buddhism with Red Meat and Whiskey. And Suzanne Friedman, Associate Professor of Educational Psychology at the University of Northern Iowa. She'll tell us about the Dalai Lama's perspective on forgiveness. All about Buddhism this hour. First, a look at this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The 14th Dalai Lama of Tibet is scheduled to visit the University of Northern Iowa Tuesday, May 18th. To share his views on the importance of education in an increasingly global society. Tickets for the renowned Tibetan spiritual leader's visit were snatched up very quickly, and in many circles in the state, it's created quite a buzz of anticipation. So this hour, we ask the question, what is Buddhism, and who was the Buddha? We look at the origins of Buddhism and how it has become adapted to Western culture, how it has become a part of Iowa's culture. A little later, Stephen Asma will join us. He's the author of the new book, Why I Am a Buddhist, No-Nonsense Buddhism with Red Meat and Whiskey. And Suzanne Friedman of the University of Northern Iowa will talk about the Dalai Lama's perspective on forgiveness. But first, here's a preview of a new two-hour PBS documentary to air next Wednesday on IPTV that features the Dalai Lama, among others, and it's narrated by Richard Gere.
He lived in India 2,500 years ago. Echoes of his world still remain. The Buddha, the Indian sage whose story inspired one of the world's great religions, Buddhism, the fourth largest religion in the world. He was the son of a king, a pampered prince who abandoned a life of pleasure to seek enlightenment.
Even Buddha himself, in order to get final enlightenment, need hard work.
It was an arduous spiritual journey.
He was eating one grain of rice per day. He was standing on one foot. He was sleeping on nails.
Finally, meditating under the Bodhi tree, he attained the supreme wisdom.
There is no knowledge won without sacrifice. In order to gain anything, you must first lose everything.
David Grubin is the award-winning filmmaker, writer, and director of this new PBS documentary, The Buddha, to air on IPTV Wednesday, April 7th at 7 p.m. David Grubin joins us now by phone live. Good afternoon to you, David.
Good afternoon.
A lot has been written about the Buddha. Many films have been made about him. Anything to do with the U.S. becoming more diverse, also spiritually, that the reason you're bringing out this film now?
Well, I do think that that Buddhism is a very adaptable religion. That is, it started in India, but it spread to Tibet and Korea, to China, to Japan, and every place it adapted to the culture. Zen Buddhism in Japan, and Theravada Buddhism in Southeast Asia. Now it's coming to America, yes, and the Buddhist practices are spreading very rapidly. It's hard to find somebody who doesn't know something about meditation or has tried some meditation or has gone to a retreat. So I think that in our time of violence and bewildering spiritual confusion, I think people are turning to these practices and to this millennia-old accumulated wisdom that's found in Buddhism.
As I mentioned in the introduction, the Dalai Lama will be visiting Iowa in a matter of weeks. What is the connection between the Dalai Lama and the Buddha, Buddhism?
Well, the Dalai Lama is the head of the Tibetan Buddhism. That's Tibetan Buddhism has its own kind of Buddhism. It's different than the Japanese, as I was saying. But I think it's a more profound connection than just being a spiritual leader of a particular group. I mean, he, for many people, embodies the practices of the Buddha and the wisdom and the compassion of the Buddha. He is sort of a living example of what one can learn from Buddhist practice.
Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, this person, how much of his story we hear revealed in the 2-hour documentary that you will have next week premiering, how much of his story is fact, how much fiction, how much of it matters?
Well, that is a very good question, because when I started out, I did want to know, well, what about the historical Buddha, the prince Siddhartha? What about, how much can we know about that? And what I found out was that in the 19th century, scholars went in search of the historical Buddha, and they came up empty-handed. That is, they couldn't find anything about him because the historical Buddha passes into legend and myth almost immediately upon his death. So there is an oral tradition, but no scholar now today tries to find out where the Buddha was really born. But as you were saying, to me, it doesn't really matter, because what's important is the story of the Buddha and the meaning in the story and the message of hope that the story carries.
So what is that message in a nutshell? We hear in that introduction that the Buddha, under the Bodhi tree, attained supreme wisdom. What is supreme wisdom?
let me tell you a story. There was a young Buddhist monk, and he saw an older monk on the other side of the river, and he wanted to get to this older monk because he was wise and learned, and he called out to him, and he said, oh revered one, the river is so wide, how do I get to the other side? And the old wise monk called back, you already are on the other side. Now think about that for a moment. In a certain way, it's saying, you don't need me. You are already there if you could find it for yourself. The supreme wisdom is in the moment. It's here and it's now, and it's up to you to see if you can find this nirvana in the moment. You're already enlightened, but you don't really know it.
I'd like to play another cut from your film, David, that I found particularly interesting. You have a number of people talking about the Buddha in your film. The Dalai Lama, we heard, W.S. Merwin, and the poet Jane Hirschfield. This is Jane Hirschfield talking about, I think, what falls into the category of misconceptions about Buddhism. Let's listen to Jane Hirschfield.
Buddhism is not about being special. Buddhism is about being ordinary. And it is not about the continual exudation of bliss. It is about walking a normal human life with normal human beings doing normal human things. And this reminds you that you yourself might be a Buddha at this moment. The person you're looking at might be one. It's an interesting practice. Just each person you see as you walk down the street, Buddha, 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 Buddha.
So what does that mean, David, to recognize a Buddha in everyone you see? David Gruben.
In the film, what Jane says earlier is, what the Buddha found, we can find. So what that means is that the Buddha was a human being, and he's a model for us. As the Dalai Lama also said, it takes hard work. Let's not think that this is a kind of an airy-fairy, touchy-feely thing. It takes hard work, and it isn't easy. But you can use the Buddha as a model, and he did give certain practices and a certain pathway to help you find this Buddha within yourself, your own Buddha nature. And that what it really is saying is that very similar to thing to what Jesus said, the kingdom of God is within you. Many great religions say the same thing.
How compatible is Buddhism with, say, Christianity? Can one be both a Christian and a Buddhist?
Again, that's a wonderful, wonderful question. You can be a Jew, you can be a Muslim, you can be a Christian, you can be a person with no particular faith and take Buddhist practices and Buddhist wisdom into your life. That is, you can continue to be Christian or Jewish, and those Buddhist practices will fit in. In other words, the contemplative practices of meditation, they don't contradict anything in Judaism or in Christianity. And I think that's one of the reasons that Buddhism is spreading. I mean, it is a religion, and you can join the Buddhist religion, but you can also work with that this wisdom tradition. And, you know, the Jewish Christian tradition has a millennial-old wisdom tradition, too, that has much to teach us.
Are these other great religions welcoming, generally, of that, that you can be both, that you can take the Buddhist practices into Islam, into Judaism or Christianity?
Well, many of them are. I mean, I think, every religion has different pieces of it. Americans are known for switching religions. You know, if you look at any of those surveys, Americans are always switching around. They're always tasting, trying. So I don't think Americans have trouble adapting and changing and making use of what they need in their own spiritual searching.
How many people do you know consider themselves Buddhists in the United States, do you think? Any estimates on that?
It's very tiny. Very tiny consider themselves Buddhists, but there's a growing population of people that are using the Buddhist practices. And that's, I think, because the Buddhist practice, there's a part of it that has to do with this kind of a therapeutics. You know, it's a very pragmatic. It has to do with personal change, transformation, growth. That's very American, and we can use that. And so, though there are a very small number of Buddhists, there are very, very many people who have Buddhist practices in their life.
Okay, we want to take a short break and come back with director of the new PBS documentary, The Buddha. David Grubin is joining us live by phone. That documentary, two-hour documentary, premieres next Wednesday, April 7th, in our time zone, starting at 7 p.m. on IPTV. Are you a Buddhist living in the Midwest? What drew you to Buddhism? Tell us your experience this hour. Or maybe you're not a Buddhist. What questions do you have about the Buddha or Buddhism? 1-866-780-9100, our toll-free number. 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. More on the fascination of the study of Buddhism when we come back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. The 14th Dalai Lama of Tibet is scheduled to visit Iowa in May, and that's why we're taking this opportunity to look at Buddhism and the fascination with it in the United States. David Grubin is with us until half past the hour, director of the new PBS documentary to premiere next Wednesday on IPTV. The Buddha is its title. It's a two-hour documentary Wednesday, April 7th. And David, joining us by phone, there are artifacts in this film. We see a lot of beautiful work, some artifacts in this film, and this documentary is tied to a new exhibition. What artifacts are we seeing in the film?
Well, to tell the story of the Buddha on film, I was able to draw on 2,500 years of Buddhist art and sculpture, some of the most magnificent works of art ever conceived. And so those works can tell the story of the Buddha's birth, the story of his enlightenment, of his first teaching. So I'm drawing on that work. The Asia Society in New York has an exhibition right now about Buddhist art and pilgrimage, and Buddhists make pilgrimage to the place where the Buddha was born, where he achieved enlightenment, where he gave his first teaching, and where he died. Those places are part of a sacred biography, and they're associated with beautiful works of art.
I'd like to welcome into our conversation Stephen Asma. He is the author of Buddha for Beginners, and his new book is Why I Am a Buddhist, No-Nonsense Buddhism with Red Meat and Whiskey. He is a professor of philosophy and interdisciplinary humanities at Columbia College in Chicago. Stephen has lived in Cambodia and China and traveled extensively throughout Southeast Asia. He joins us by phone from Chicago. Good afternoon, Stephen.
Good afternoon.
Great to have you with us. In your book, you write that you want to take the California out of Buddhism. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, no disrespect to Californians. I have friends and family there. But I'm sort of indicating that there are certain misconceptions about Buddhism, some of which I think David was also mentioning. I think the New Age movement sort of co-opted Buddhism and connected it to a lot of magical thinking, you know, quantum healing, energy crystals, you know, Gucci yoga mats, tantric sex. And I'm basically trying to rescue Buddhism because Buddhism is a more common sense, down-to-earth, practical set of practices. And its philosophy is also, on its own terms, quite rigorous and not quite as mystical as I think the New Age folks out in California. So I'm promoting a Chicago-style or Midwestern Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. So here's a question for you both, to start with you, Stephen. Is Buddhism a religion or a philosophy, or simply a meditation technique?
Well, it really is both. You can, if you've grown up in the Midwest, as I have, there are many Americans who came to Buddhism sort of like you come to a second language. You study it in books and you take courses on it. And there is, in fact, a core teaching in Buddhism, which is a philosophy. And the philosophy is contained in the Four Noble Truths. Very quickly, the first noble truth of the Buddha is that all life is suffering. The second noble truth is that suffering is caused by craving or desire. The third noble truth is that if you can stop this craving or desire, you can stop suffering. And the fourth noble truth is sort of an eight-step program by which you can pull this off. So those are philosophical ideas, and they can be adopted by people of all kinds of faiths. But it is also the case, having lived all over Asia, that Buddhism is a religion. It's also a set of devotional practices, and it also basically involves some of the faith-based devotions that we would regularly recognize as religious.
Mm-hmm. David Grubin, anything to add to that on the question of religion or philosophy?
Well, I agree with what Stephen said, and just would add that Buddhists have, over hundreds and hundreds of years, elaborated a very complex philosophy out of the Four Noble Truths and the Buddhist teachings, which focus around the idea of impermanence and change and interconnectedness and transience, ideas like that, which, again, are very relevant today, especially the interconnectedness, you know, the way in which our whole world is connected is a given today. The Buddha talked about the connectedness between all things 2,500 years ago.
Okay, we want to ask our listeners to join our conversation as well. If you'd like to ask a question of David or Stephen, or perhaps you are a Buddhist, tell us your experience. What questions do you have? 1-866-780-9100, our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Kit is joining us, first of all, from Manly. Good afternoon, Kit.
Hi.
Go ahead. What do you think of our conversation? Are you a Buddhist?
I am a Buddhist. I'm Theravada. I have been for about 17, 18 years now.
Tell us what Theravada means, quickly.
Oh, gee. There's no simple way. It's the school common in the South. We would probably be the ones who we would say were the most original, although, you know, the Northern schools would not probably agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
We are sometimes called the lesser vehicle. We're a bit strict and a bit rational and very
uh-huh.
It goes very well with the Midwest, being very pragmatic and rational and following strictly the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths.
Kit, how does it feel to be a Buddhist in the Midwest? The Midwest is not a big place for Buddhists, or do you find? Do you feel a little isolated?
I do feel a little isolated sometimes, and especially as I tend to be a religious Buddhist, which is not the common. People tend to be more, like you were talking about, philosophical or use meditation without being religiously Buddhist, whereas I try to be religiously Buddhist, and so I go occasionally to the temple in Des Moines and give respect to Buddhist statues and various that venerate, and things that are very religious, but also I meditate, and it's sometimes, I would say it's lonely, but it's close to unique.
Well, what do you find that people have as misconceptions about you as a Buddhist? What do they expect when they meet you, and do you immediately tell them you are a Buddhist, or does that take a while to get out of you?
Usually it takes a while. I mean, it doesn't just, I don't wear some sign telling people that I'm Buddhist. I have not really had any hostility. I just haven't had a lot of connection. And people are usually very curious, have a lot of questions. They often will have misconceptions, or they'll have very little bits of information from various different schools, like Zen, which is more Japanese, or perhaps some of the Chinese schools, the Pure Land sect, or they know of the Dalai Lama and know some things about Tibetan Buddhism, and those things are often somewhat distant from my form of Buddhism. But people have always been curious and respectful, and I haven't had problems being Buddhist in the Midwest.
Okay. Kit, thank you very much for your view, your experience as a Buddhist in the Midwest, as we talk about Buddhism this hour. And David Grubin is director of the new PBS documentary, The Buddha. David, it's been great to have you with us on the show, and we look forward to watching your new documentary.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
David Grubin, The Buddha is his new film on IPTV, premiering next Wednesday, April 7th at 7 p.m. And we want to take your calls as well after we take a short break. Are you a Buddhist living in the Midwest? What drew you to Buddhism? Tell us your experience. What questions do you have about Buddha or Buddhism? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Still with us, Stephen Asma from Chicago, Why I Am a Buddhist, his latest book, No Nonsense Buddhism with Red Meat and Whiskey. We have just a few seconds before we have to go to a break, but Stephen, you do address, as Kit did, misconceptions about Buddhism in the West. You don't have to give away your money and shave your head to be a good Buddhist, do you?
No, that's right. There's the sense that I think Americans see Buddhism through these wonderful characters like the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh, but these guys are monks. And I need to assure people that the vast majority of Buddhists living in Asian countries are lay people. They're like you and I. They get up, they go to work, they have kids, they have drinks, they eat. They live a life of moderation in the middle path, but they don't live these ascetic, austere lives.
Okay, very good. We'll go away for a break. Perhaps we'll meet more Buddhists who are listening to our program. 1-866-780-9100 when we come back in just over 5 minutes. 1-866-780-9100, or email us now, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Taking the announcement of the Dalai Lama's visit to Iowa in May as a reason to look at Buddhism this hour, we hope you'll come back and join our conversation. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Good to have you with us on The Exchange over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer here on Iowa Public Radio. Ever wonder how coffee became the crux of our culture? Well, tomorrow on this program, we talk with author Mark Pendergrast. His new book, Uncommon Grounds, recounts the history of coffee and how it transformed our world. We'll also talk with a man who runs a coffee shop at a church in Ames, the owner of a coffee shop in a West Des Moines library, and a man who aims to visit every Starbucks in the world. He's already been to nearly 10,000 of them. That's tomorrow, a look at coffee culture. Today, we're looking at Buddhism, specifically Buddhism in the Midwest. The Dalai Lama of Tibet will be visiting Iowa in May. So this hour, we're looking at the origins of Buddhism. How has it been adapted to Western culture? how it has become a part of Iowa's culture. We'd like you to join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Before we do go to those calls, by the way, we do have David Grubin, not David Grubin, who was with us in the first half hour, director of the new PBS documentary, The Buddha. He left us, and we have Stephen Asma with us still. He is the author of Why I Am a Buddhist, No-Nonsense Buddhism with Red Meat and Whiskey, joining us from Chicago. Also joining us now, Suzanne Friedman is with us, and Suzanne is at the University of Northern Iowa as an associate professor of educational psychology and foundations. Good afternoon to you, Suzanne.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
This is great to have you. You recently gave a talk titled Forgiveness and the Dalai Lama. Tell us, how is the Dalai Lama's take on forgiveness different from our general idea of it?
Well, I should say that I have studied the psychology of forgiveness for over 20 years, and in my research and examination of forgiveness from a psychological perspective, there are, in the general population, there are a great deal of misconceptions about what it means to forgive and what forgiveness is. So the Dalai Lama actually has a very similar view of forgiveness that I do and people I study with do, but there are some differences. And one of the misconceptions the general population has about forgiveness is that anger is not part of the process. And we have a 20-unit model of forgiving. And the second unit in the model is the confrontation of anger. Mm. And that before you can forgive, you need to get angry about what happened to you. You have a right to be angry. And I think it's easier to forgive and move beyond your anger when you are validated for your anger. Because if someone hurt you deeply, personally, and unfairly, then you a normal and natural feeling is anger.
What do you most look forward to in the visit of the Dalai Lama?
Just hearing more about his perspective. I read the book, The Art of Happiness, for a lot of the information that came from my talk, and there were so many similarities in our 20-unit model of forgiveness. I want to hear more of what he says about, systematic training of the mind. That's one difference between our view and his view. We believe in expressing our anger in a healthy way. He talks about systematically training the mind so that if you hear something disturbing or someone does something, unfair to you or hurtful to you, that it doesn't even go beyond the surface of the mind. You feel it. It's like a ripple.
Mm.
So what Cheech says takes a lot of effort. It doesn't happen overnight.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Asma, you talk about this in your book, and this is where Suzanne is getting at, too. You write about Buddhist monks and neuroscientists talking to each other when we talk about psychology, neuroscience, that Buddhism and science really have an overlap here, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. There's a new dialogue that's happening between really good meditators and neuroscientists. And I think, as Susan was pointing out, there's a kind of misunderstanding about Buddhism, which is that somehow you're not supposed to feel anything. And in fact, the Buddha argues that you're going to have pains and pleasures and emotional responses to things. That's what it means to be an organism. You can't deny that. It's just the second phase. The Buddha says you have to stop. The second phase is when the ego consciousness jumps in and tries to hold on to pleasures. And this, he thinks, is a kind of cognitive problem that can be re-educated and retrained. So meditators and Buddhists like the Dalai Lama are very good at recognizing some kind of anger or happiness in them and then taking a sort of detached sort of relationship to it. You experience it, but you don't keep chasing after it so that it doesn't turn into an obsession. That's really the difference.
I want to reach out to our listeners for the rest of the hour. Are you a Buddhist living in the Midwest? What drew you to Buddhism? Tell us your experience or what questions you have about the Buddha or Buddhism or the Dalai Lama. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Garrett is joining us from Mason City. Good afternoon, Garrett.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, Garrett. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I was intrigued earlier when you guys were discussing the different thought groups, one being religious practitioners, I guess you could call it, and the other being more of a philosophical student of Buddhism. And I was curious, as it relates to the religious group, did Buddha ever make any claims to deity himself? And even further, how does the religious practitioner thought group see Buddha? Do they see him as a God figure, et cetera, et cetera?
Great question, Garrett. Let me throw that to Stephen. Is Buddha a God?
Very good question. The Buddha emphatically denied that he was a divinity. He said over and over again, I'm just a man, and I've become awake, and all of you can become awake too. You can work on your own enlightenment with diligence. But it's true that shortly after his death, very quickly, he became deified, and people began to think of him more as a god and to sort of idolize him. And this is just one of those interesting differences between the sort of, you know, we see this in Christianity frequently too. There's what the actual person, the founder, said and taught, and then there's what has sort of accumulated over time in the religious culture. And there's a, yeah, there's a disconnect there.
Mm-hmm. So when Buddhists are praying, who are they praying to, and what are they praying for?
Well, technically, they're not praying. It's an interesting point. Technically, what they're doing is they're looking to the Buddha to inspire them to work on themselves using Buddhist methods. So they're looking for inspiration. But it is all, and so it's not prayer in that sense. But I also have to acknowledge, having lived in Cambodia and China, that people do go and pray to the Buddha, and it's very much like Christian praying to the Christian God. They want the God to help them. Whether, you know, a child might be sick, just the usual sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So it's really both those things are going on in the same community.
Suzanne, do you run into this misconception as well, that Buddha is a deity? And in fact, he never said anything like that, as far as we know.
I haven't really seen that in my research, but I haven't delved into that area.
Okay.
So that hasn't been my experience.
Okay, let's go to Ellen in Center Point. Ellen dialed 1-866-780-9100. Good afternoon, Ellen.
Hi, how are you?
Yes, we're fine. What have you got to add to our conversation? Are you a Buddhist?
Yes, absolutely. For the last 4 years, Buddhism has transformed my life. And, you know, I'm not like some crackpot. I, you know, had a career. I was very stuck in it. It was very stressful to me. And literally, this is a timely topic because I am driving out of the state of Iowa. I just shut my business down, and I am relocating to Minneapolis and starting a new life. Mm. And it's because I was able to overcome my fear. And that is just something that Buddhism allows you to do. Once you become enlightened and once you understand some things about being mindful and not suffering or grasping on to things that you cannot have, or trying to keep on, hold on to things that you do have that are just causing you a lot of pain.
Mm. So it was really for you this central teaching of recognizing your cravings, your desires, and seeing that's the source of suffering in life, huh?
Absolutely. And fear. Fear is a powerful motivator. Fear is what keeps most of us hitting the same button every day, because we are afraid that if we stop hitting that button, bad things, even worse things will happen.
Stephen Asma, what is your reaction to Ellen's story here?
Well, I think that's right. She's expressing one of the really healthy therapeutic aspects of Buddhism, which is that it allows us to see the Buddha grew up in the religious cultures of Hinduism, where you went and you appealed to the gods to help fix your problems. And he came to that and he said, wait a second, that's not going to work. You can't get the external world to get in line with your wants and desires, but you can reshape your own mind. You can discipline your mind. And that is the therapeutic aspect of Buddhism that I think gives people some liberation and some sense of freedom where they previously didn't feel it.
Mm-hmm. And really lines up with the ideas of psychology, specifically cognitive therapy.
Right. That's right. It's no accident that in America, it was many psychologists that were originally drawn to Buddhism. And so you'll see a lot of sort of back and forth between those two communities.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting, Ellen is still on the line, that Ellen started off, and Stephen addressed this, because she said, I am not some kind of crackpot. Now, that that points us to one of the misconceptions, the cliches about Buddhism, doesn't it, Stephen?
Yeah, there is a general sense that, you know, you've got to basically become a hippie and have energy crystals around your neck or something like this in order to be a Buddhist, and that's really not the case. There's also, I think, it's also incorrect that you've got to become like a totally humorless, you know, lettuce nibbler with no sense of other sort of passions in life, and neither one of these things is true. Buddhism is a way of life that's way more down to earth than that.
Okay. Alan, we'll let you on your way. We want to wish you good luck while you're driving to Minneapolis. We're sorry to lose you in the state, but as you drive and nibble your lettuce and adjust those crystals, we wish you well.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Alan joining us from Center Point. Let's go to Rock Island. Joseph, hi. Joseph, are you there from Rock Island? Joseph, not there. Let's go to Jim. Jim, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, Jim, go ahead. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Rock Island.
You're from Rock Island. Very good, Jim. What have you got to add? Are you a Buddhist?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's your experience? What do you want to add?
Well, for me, it was my connection with philosophy to, as an atheist, to I seem to connect with people that are existentialist a lot more than I do with people that are like the energy crystal wearing hippie set. And I think people expect someone who's a Buddhist to be into this sort of mystical aspect of things, where I'm a Theravada Buddhist. So, like, I don't, the Dalai Lama, for me, I don't see him as a typically important religious figure. I look at the original text of the Buddha, and as a system of thinking, it answered and solved a lot of problems that were in philosophy for me.
For you, Jim, another very practical application of Buddhism in your life.
Yeah, like meditation in order to help get rid of anger. And that's really good.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Jim, calling from Rock Island, 1-866-780-9100, if you're a Buddhist, or perhaps you're not and would like to know more about it. Perhaps you've heard things about Buddhism that you would like to have clarified. 1-866-780-9100. The exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Suzanne Friedman, Professor Friedman, you a lot of anticipation in the state, especially in Cedar Falls, I imagine, with the coming visit of the Dalai Lama.
A lot of excitement.
What are the facets of that anticipation that you have noticed?
Oh, just, you know, people are so excited to have such a worldwide figure come to Cedar Falls and share his message about education. And I just think a lot of the principles that we talk about, that we desire as a society, is what the Dalai Lama, is his whole message. One of the things that you were talking about earlier in that documentary about the woman who was saying Buddha, 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 the Dalai Lama talks about this idea of inner worth. And he states that whether it's an old friend or a new friend, there's not much difference anyway, because I always believe we are the same. We are all human beings. Of course, there may be differences in cultural background or way of life. There may be differences in our faith, or we may be of a different color, but we are all human beings consisting of the human body and the human mind. And I think that's a really important message, this idea that putting aside our differences, and I think that's how he relates to people, that all human beings are equal and equally worthy of respect.
Stephen, Asma, an email for you. How do you reconcile the idea of living in the current lifetime with red meat and whiskey? That's part of the title of your book. And the commitment, she writes, to live and practice for future lives.
It's hard to determine exactly what's meant by that question, because I'm not sure if that's a reference to reincarnation and karma. It sounds like it might be.
Well, I think the fact that you're taking life when you eat red meat, right?
Right. Let me address that. It's a good point. I think the assumption is that if you're a Buddhist, you can't kill anything, and that is actually not contained in the original teachings of the Buddha. For one, you're not going to last long on the planet if that's your philosophy. But even the Buddha ate meat. the point in Buddhism is not that there's something intrinsically wrong with eating animals. The problem that the Buddha focused on was suffering. If we can consume meat, but the animal can be killed in the most humane possible way, in other words, you know, clearly factory farming is bad, and we've got to have more free range and quick and painless killing. If that's the case, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with eating animals. It's the suffering that's objectionable. And so with that in mind, I think we have to remember that that ties in with the Buddha's general philosophy of a middle way.
Judy is joining us from West Des Moines as our hour is running away from us. Judy, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I'd just like to add, I'm not a Buddhist, but I do practice the meditation and I do the readings. And the piece that I like about that is the compassion, in that when there's anger that arises, not to discount it, not to deny it, but whomever was involved with that or inflicted it, it helps to look at, in terms of compassion, what might this person be going through that he or she would inflict such harm, knowingly or unknowingly.
And I think Suzanne's, Professor Friedman's work on this and forgiveness, compassion is a path towards forgiveness to conquer anger?
Yes, exactly. And one of the things that helps it, people develop compassion and empathy for someone who may have hurt them deeply is the idea of what the guest caller is talking about, is the idea of reframing, and that's what we call it in the forgiveness process. And the Dalai Lama says the ability to shift one's perspective can be one of the most powerful and effective tools that we have in helping us cope with hurt. So if someone hurt you, we have a tendency to see that person as a monster. But if we could try to find out some information about why that person may have done the hurtful action, what was going on in their life. I've worked with incest survivors, and in helping the incest survivor forgive their abuser, one of the deepest hurts a person can experience, helping the incest survivor learn information that maybe their abuser was actually abused themselves, not to make excuses or condone the hurtful action, but to better understand, like the caller said, how it could have occurred, and maybe to recognize some of the positive things about the person who hurt you. And the Dalai Lama, I think, is really interesting because he goes even further and says that in terms of reframing, we can view the person who hurt us as helpful in the sense that he or she gave us the necessary condition for practicing patience. So we can consider our enemy as a great teacher and maybe even revere them for giving us this precious opportunity for growth, which that's kind of hard to swallow, that you're thankful for the person who caused you this deep pain because they're helping you practice patience and tolerance and develop compassion.
Coming full circle, at the beginning of the program, we heard the Dalai Lama talk about how hard the work was to go this path. Judy, thank you from West Des Moines. Before our hour gets away, I want to ask Stephen this question, because it is another thing that I think that sets Buddhism apart from the other major religions. What does Buddhism say about the afterlife? Is there an afterlife? So much of the focus of Islam, Christianity, is on the afterlife.
Yeah, this is a great question, and it's quite it's a bit of a confusion. Many people sort of confuse the Buddha's ideas with the earlier Hindu teachings, because the Buddha uses language about rebirth and karma. But in point of fact, the Buddha does not believe and argues against the existence of an immortal soul that will go on from one life to another. Now, this is sort of shocking for people because they assume that's part of the philosophy, and it's not. He criticizes Hinduism and the belief in the permanent soul. And instead, what he says is that we're actually these bundles of energy. He describes us as having these five major sort of categories of energy. I'm not going to get into that, but the point is, when we die, what goes on is this energy. And the idea is to create as good a future as you can by acting well in this life. And so the notion of karma here is quite subtle and, I think, refined. And it's a little more in keeping with the scientific ideas about energy conservation and so forth. So that's an aspect of Buddhism that it's called the anatta theory, or the no soul or no self theory. That's not well understood in the West, and it probably should be.
Stephen Asma, in the final minute or so, I want to give you the really big question to go out on. According to Buddhism, what is the goal of life, the point of it? And I'm going to say it, yes, the meaning of it.
that's a big question. I would say for Buddhists, the point is twofold, and it's related. One is, how can we reduce suffering in the world? And secondly, and related, how can we increase compassion? That's really the goal of Buddhism, and it has this naturalistic, psychological approach to doing those things.
Mm-hmm. Professor Friedman, are you a Buddhist or have Buddhist practices in your life?
Well, because I study the forgiveness, the psychology of forgiveness, I don't define myself as a Buddhist, but I would say that I follow a lot of the Buddhist principles. And what I thought was interesting when you asked about the message of Buddhism, well, you know, the Dalai Lama says, you know, all of that, how compassion and forgiveness are so essential for finding happiness. And he really talks about finding happiness for individuals and practicing that compassion and forgiveness. So I do believe I practice a lot of the principles
Very
of Buddhism.
Good. Professor Suzanne Friedman, thank you for joining us from the University of Northern Iowa. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Associate Professor of Educational Psychology and Foundations studies forgiveness. And also thanks to you, Stephen Asma, joining us from Chicago. His latest book, Why I Am a Buddhist, No-Nonsense Buddhism with Red Meat and Whiskey. Stephen, thank you for joining us for this hour.
Thank you very much.
The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins, our producer assistant today, Christina Sarnelli. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for all the callers and emails today. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.